change this beat up. I love it. I love this beat, but we got to change it up eventually, right? No, we won't change it. Just after 8 o'clock here, Fox Sports Radio, 98.9 FM, 1340 AM, the flagship station of the Vegas Golden Knights. Of course, you're here every morning with us. This is Out of Line. I'm Caleb Herring, not your usual host, Brian Feldman, who is taking vacation because he knew that I was right about the Super Bowl and he didn't want to face me today. No, he's just taking the day off because he's one of the hardest working guys I know. He's always busy. He's exhausted. You can see it in his face if you watch the Facebook Live. He's just a tired man, so he needed a day off. But we are live here in the Fox Sports Residential Bank Corp studio, as we are every Sunday morning, giving you our takes on the latest in sports news and entertainment. The we, of course, like I mentioned, doesn't include Brian Feldman, but as usual, the man on the boards, the Hall of Famer, now married man, Chris Magnum Chapman, of course, doubles as the Vegas Golden Knights locker room correspondent. And this week, the intern bumped up to co-host for this week.
No pressure?
No pressure at all, Spence. I won't do anything like that to you. Spence,
you gonna try
Douglas!
My, you going to try my last name?
Ostrovsky.
I'm impressed.
Ostrovsky. Yeah, I could do it. I didn't need a month of Hooked on Phonics to do it either. So, I mean, you know, I did look at it and I was like, there's too many vowels.
But I got to say, I'm most impressed because usually people say Ostrovsky, but you got it. You got the O. It's Ostrovsky.
I mean, I got you, man.
I'm flabbergasted.
The Wiz is co-hosting this week in Brian's absence. Everybody's bumped up. The show is streaming on the LV Sports Network. And, of course, on the Facebook page, O-U-T-T-A-L-I-N-E, on Facebook. Also on our personal pages, you can follow me on Twitter at Caleb Herring _, or on Facebook, just type in my name, it'll pop up. There's some imposters out there, so look for the black guy. That's me. But the lines are always open here at the Fox Sports Residential Bank Corp studio. The line number is 702-876-1340.
Hi, this is Bubby, and it's time for What's on Tap.
I'm The Wiz, and this is What's on Tap, sponsored by our title sponsor, Residential Bank Corp. Whether purchasing a new home or refinancing the home you already own, Residential Bank Corp is the company to turn to for all your home financing needs. Residential Bank Corp, funding America one neighborhood at a time. Excuse me. On tap, the Golden Knights purchased the San Antonio 8 AHL team and is bringing the team to Las Vegas. Mark Sorio proves how dominant he can be when it comes to recruiting. The rumors of Brady coming to Vegas are really starting to heat up. We give our thoughts on some NBA trades. And finally, we discuss our predictions on the Oscars tonight. I'm The Wiz, and that's What's on Tap, brought to you by our title sponsor, Residential Bank Corp. If you're looking to buy a home or refinance the home you already own, choose a company you can trust. Residential Bank Corp, funding America one neighborhood at a time.
And now he loses the puck. The other way, it's Aho. Comes in alone. He shoots. Saved by Foley. Puck the other way. It's Stastny. Taps it along. Theodore with Stastny. 8 seconds. Theodore shoots. Glove save. Trickling puck at the line. No. It stays out. 5 seconds to play.
Hockey players, as you know, are warriors. They don't give up. They come to play every game.
It's time for Nightcap, a cup full of the Vegas Golden Knights. From highlights to interviews to special events, the puck starts here.
Starts here. Last night it stopped for the Golden Knights. I was excited yesterday to come in and talk about the Knights and how they were doing good and finished a road trip with a big win, 7-2 over the Panthers. Some pretty good things there. Fleury moves to the fifth all time as far as victories. In the NHL. So we were excited. Like you mentioned before, Wiz, they purchased an AHL team, the San Antonio Rampage, relocating presumably to Henderson. Haven't found a name yet for the team. We'll talk about that in a minute. But then last night happened. Everything was good.
Seemed like it for
two periods. We were high on it. The fans were going crazy. The Knights were up 4-2. We were enjoying that. And then all of a sudden, the train fell off the tracks. And the Knights, in a disaster, lost in a shootout. So I'm going to go to you first, Mags. Last night's game, was that kind of the Knights season in a microcosm, like in a bottle? If you could bottle up the Knights season so far, was that game full of the highs of victory and then the absolute lows of losing a game that you had in the bag? Is that pretty much sum up what the Knights have done this season?
Well, yeah. I mean, all season it's been inconsistent play. And this is now, I believe, the third or fourth time that they've blown it. Actually, I think it's the fifth time that they've blown a two-goal lead at T-Mobile Arena. They blew one against Boston in the third game of the season. I think they blew one against Nashville. They I believe they blew one against Montreal. There's another one in there. And then last night, obviously, at two different occasions, they had two-goal leads. They get a shorthanded goal to take a 4-2 lead in the third period, and you're thinking at that point, the game is over. Hold on just a minute. Carolina, relentless. They don't go away. Golden Knights take their foot off the gas a little bit. Some people indicating that maybe because of some fatigue played a factor, right?
You
fly in the day before from the East Coast where you'd been for 8 days. And to an extent, I'm willing to accept that as a reasonable answer or a reasonable explanation, because let's be real. I mean, you travel, I travel. I mean, hell, I just came back from Japan a week and a half ago.
Oh, there's definitely some jet lag.
And I'm still recovering a little bit. So, there definitely is something to that. Now, I'm not a professional athlete, so I don't know how the rigors of travel affect guys who are in pristine shape. But you know what? If they tell you that that's a factor, I'm going to believe them.
Yeah.
That being said, you can't blow a two-goal lead in the third period.
No, you can't. And to the credit of the Hurricane, like you said earlier, they kept coming. It's not like they got down 4-2 and decided to mail it in. They kept coming, and they were getting shots on goal, and we talked about it before we came on. Fleury just didn't seem – he's not the same guy.
We talked
about his highs of, you know, becoming the fifth all-time winner in NHL history, and then the next game out, it's like – well, is this the cliff? Has he fallen off the cliff?
Well, the weird thing is a couple of those goals Carolina scored were fluky. And, you know, the reality is Marc-Andre Fleury will be the first guy to tell you that he needs to be better.
Right.
You know, he's that type of competitor. And I've been very lucky to get to know him a little bit over the last 2.5-3 years. And that he is his harshest critic. And he will look at last night, and he didn't even talk to the media last night, which I get. You know what? Give the guy the night to avoid people like us who are going to hound him and ask him,
right?
You know, hey, what happened? Well, we all saw what happened, and there were plays where maybe the defense was out of position, maybe the defense got a little lazy. Marc-Andre Fleury is trying to fight through screens because the defensive players aren't doing their job to get guys out of the way, and sometimes you give up goals, and last night they gave up a couple goals that they probably shouldn't have, and. Yeah. The one at the end of the first period, I think, is probably the one that you look at and you're like, that kind of was, as you said earlier, indicative of the way things have been. You dominate the first period. You can't clear a puck out of his own. Brady McNabb, who's really good at blocking shots, mistimes a play. They're unable to get the puck out of the zone. And then the guy just basically, he's throwing a puck on net
right
from the blue line, and somehow it gets through, and you're like, oh, well, all right, well, they'll come out. And then they come out early in the second period. They get their third goal, and you're like, all right, they're completely in control. They're not going to lose this game.
Right. And that's the thing to me. I think when you saw the Hurricanes score and they answered and they tried to, you know, make it close again, and then as the home team, especially with the crowd, the energy of T-Mobile Arena, when you then extend the lead again, when you kind of pull away again, it's like, okay, we've got this. It's in the bag. And there was that feeling watching the game that, okay, 4-2, we got it. Like, there's no way. And then the avalanche of attack from the Hurricanes, that's kind of a play on natural disasters. But it's like you go down, and then at that point, once it goes to overtime, you don't feel confident at all. I think the people in the arena are on pins and needles.
Well, the worst part about that is you get the penalty at the end of the third period with 57 seconds to go in the game, and you're like, all right, they're either going to win the game here with the power play goal, or they're going to go into overtime and win in a power play goal, because they're going to have a one-man advantage for a minute and 3 seconds.
Into the overtime, yeah.
And, I mean, the thing is, like, they didn't even look like they had any semblance of a power play on either of those.
Our power play yesterday, just in general, was awful.
Well, they didn't have very many opportunities. And
hasn't it been awful all season? I feel like that's been a common theme as well, that the power plays have not been very successful. They haven't had success on power plays.
Now, I look at this and I say, all right, now they're back on the road Tuesday, which is just a really really weird scheduling setup by the NHL, right? Like, the team is away from home for 28 days. I mean, and that's no excuse, right? But they're away from home for 28 days. You have a 10-day break for the All-Star and the bye week.
Yep.
Then they're back on the road for another 4 games. They come home for one night.
And they're right
and they're back on the road. And then they're home for five straight. So
five
it's like
homestand starts with the Blues, Islanders, Capitals, Lightning, and Panthers.
And
so
that's not easy.
That's a tough schedule. For your homestand to be that, there's no relief in that. You know, you're home, but there's no relief.
Every single team, first game, defending Stanley Cup champions. Second game, a team that beat you earlier in the year at their building on Long Island, but fighting for a playoff spot. The Capitals, who were the Stanley Cup champs two years ago,
and beat you,
and are looking at Alexander Ovechkin becoming one of the elite. Well, he's already been elite, but
goat status.
700 goals, he's approaching that. Then you get Tampa Bay, who just beat you, and you played a fantastic game, and they still beat you.
Yeah.
And then Florida, who you know is going to be looking for revenge after you embarrassed them down in Sunrise the other night.
So it's not a homestand, but it's not really a relief. And that's tough because I think the Knights need a little bit of relief, especially after the way they lost this one. This was kind of a heartbreaking loss. They should have had this one. They lost it. But moving on to some things that are exciting about what's going on with the Golden Knights. We mentioned it earlier that they purchased the San Antonio Rampage, an AHL team. They're going to be the affiliate team taking over that spot from the Chicago Wolves, and that is huge, not only for the Vegas market as far as hockey and growing the sport and growing the brand of the VGK in the community, but just for the team in general. It's going to be a lot easier to re-sign and move players from the AHL team and bump them up to the roster should they be needed. They had, I think it was the second longest trip for a minor league affiliate team to come to their home team, when Chicago to Vegas. If they want to call somebody up from Chicago, they have to fly, I think it was 1,700 miles or something like that, from Chicago to Vegas. It's a long trip. It's the second longest in the NHL. So this is a huge move. It'll grow the sport in Vegas. It'll only help the branding of the Golden Knights, which is already off to a phenomenal start as a young franchise here in Vegas. But having the AHL team here will definitely help that out. Interestingly enough, I don't think the team's been named yet. I know as of Thursday, it wasn't named yet. There's been some funny names thrown out there. And I think keeping with the medieval, knights thing, I think we have to keep something sort of along that line for them. I was going to throw out the Kingsmen. Like, I don't know how that works, but let's make it the
Henderson
Kingsmen.
Well, Vegas is running out of names because they go for gambling. You got the Las Vegas Aces. We got the soccer team, which is the Lights. So
I don't know where the Knights came from in all this. I don't know how we landed on
Knights.
The
only thing I think left is silver. I mean, we're at the Silver State, so maybe something with
silver dollars. That's weird, though,
silver
right?
Silver dollars. Like, that sounds kind of cool. So I can get behind that.
How about we tap into the mob here? Like, we,
that
the
is
mobsters.
A big part
like,
of
how
our
about
city
that?
History.
That's a part of our city history, right? Let's do that.
I can get behind that.
Yeah, I get behind it. But something like that is definitely on the horizon. That's a good thing for the community to have that minor league team growing the sport. You see kids of players who now live in the community who are interested in the sport. This gives them another opportunity. Presumably, it's going to be in Henderson. It said the Vegas Valley area, but
Henderson
is the number one spot, I think, to put that. Henderson's growing as far as sports facilities go. They got the Raiders
practice facility out there.
And now the AHL team's going to be out there, too.
Buy your property while you can.
Yeah, buy it while you can. But now it's time to get into some blazing. We're all going to give our blazing segments, and we'll see what we got here.
This is why I'm hot. This is why I'm hot. I'm hot because I'm fly.
Blazing segment brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, North Durango, and the 215 at Montecito Crossing Plaza. Of course, Brian and the Wiz. You also go to these parties, right? So the wing parties.
I've hosted them myself actually when Brian's not available.
Yeah, so Brian, Brian's
there.
Yeah, so he'll be there as well. But Brian's going to be hosting the next viewing party on Wednesday, February 23rd. At the Horizon Ridge location at Henderson Buffalo Wild Wings. VGK versus Washington. They'll be hosting that party. Of course, Blazeman, the segment where we give our hot topics of the week, whatever we thought was the most interesting. I'm going to save mine for last because I have a segue. So I'm going to start off with you, Mags. What do you have for Blazeman this week?
Well, I will go with something we didn't think we wanted and something we don't really need. But I would go with the return of the XFL.
Wow, you beat me to it.
It made its debut yesterday. I guess it's second debut. I guess, from all accounts, it wasn't horrible. So
right.
I guess that's a step up in the right direction from 20 years ago when it was horrible. But, I think they may have a better plan this time around. I still don't know if it's going to be successful. I mean, football so weird, like the way we view football, like it's
kind of a cornered market.
Yeah, like we only watch college in the NFL. Like everything else that's tried has kind of failed.
Right.
However, I think if they do it right, they clearly have the financial backing.
Right.
You know, it's not like the whatever it was called last year, the AFL or whatever they called that nonsense.
The AAF.
Yeah, the AAF. Just the AF.
The American Alliance.
Yeah. Gosh. You know, where this
Who came
has
up with that idea.
This has a little bit more.
More steam.
More steam. Yeah. You know, it doesn't seem like it was rushed, put together. You know, like I said, obviously the financial backing, you got ESPN on board with right. you.
Fox.
Vince McMahon.
That's a huge aspect of this, trying to keep
up. Disgustingly rich. So, and you know what? And people were talking about it. Now, we'll see what happens in week two and three and four if people are still talking about it.
Right.
But, you know, I'd like to see it be successful only because I'd like there to be another road.
Some competition, I guess.
Well, it's not even the competition.
Well, just to keep something going after the football season.
Well, it's like a guy like Caleb, right? Or I have a friend, her stepson played at East Carolina.
Right.
He had, you know, he was in camp with the New York Giants. Didn't make it, ended up in the CFL, won a championship with the Calgary Stampeders.
Right.
Now he signed a whatever the contract is where you get to go to the guys. The practice is in the spring.
Right, right. Okay.
With the Packers. But for a guy like him who doesn't make it in the NFL, to have that other opportunity to be visible to
and a large audience.
And it's not like the CFL, right? The CFL is a completely different game than, you know, the rules are different. They only get three downs as mm-hmm. opposed to four. The punting is different, right? There's different rules associated with the CFL. So I don't know how successful teams are.
The dimensions of the field even in the CFL
at finding guys from the CFL and bringing them to the NFL, whereas with the XFL, it's a little more in line with the NFL. So I think it would kind of give guys a better opportunity to showcase their skills.
Yeah.
Right? It's generally like every week is almost like a college all-star game.
And I was going to say, because I wonder how much the bounce back from the XFL will be. Like if anybody, this kind of would be the NFL playing bully ball here, but say, you know, with like back when basketball was split, when it was the ABA and, you know, all that, and Dr. J was like the highlight of that league. And he was bringing all the fandom to that league. Well, the bigger, more powerful association, which in this scenario would be the NFL, then cherry picks the best player from that league and brings him and brands him as the NBA or the NFL in that case. How much of that do I think will happen with the XFL? I don't know. Is there anybody that's going to be, I guess, kind of recruited to the NFL from the XFL? I think that would be the ultimate goal of any player that plays there, because the NFL is going to be king as far as football goes.
Well, yeah, they're going to be able to pay, they're going to be able to pay more.
So yeah,
it's more visibility.
That'd be interesting. That'd be interesting to find out. Wiz, you said he stole it. So you got a follow-up?
I got a backup. I do. I'm going to go with the Los Angeles Clippers. I don't know if we were planning on talking about that trade, but they did get the biggest piece in free agency. They got Marcus Morris, who, barring him, there were no other moves for contenders, in my opinion. Yeah. Well, maybe Marvin Williams buyout going to the Bucks. Sure. I mean, you could make an argument for that. But, you know, Marcus Morris is a 40% three-point shooter. He can score 20 points per game, and I think that's something they sorely needed. And defensively as well, he's also going to be a big part of that team.
A little bit more versatile on defense, too. Bigger body.
Yeah. Before the trade, plus they got him from the Lakers. But before that trade, I thought Lakers all the way. I just don't think the team chemistry is going to work. But now that Marcus Morris is on the team, I have to think about it a lot more. I still think the Lakers are the favorite to make the finals, but now I think the Clippers have a real chance to beat them now.
And I think you mentioned something that's important about that, because not only did they get him, they landed a good guy, a quality player, but they kept him from the Lakers. That, I think, because the Lakers expressed interest in him. And this was even before the season started. They wanted him bad before the season started, to give some depth at that four spot, to keep Kuzma playing his true position, which I think is a three, keep LeBron from having him banging the paint too much, having another post presence on the bench. So I think that was kind of the goal to get him. But yeah, that's a valid point. The Clippers were already a contender. They were the only contender, like you said, to make a major move. The Lakers didn't do anything at the trade deadline. They just kind of sat it out and waited. I think they'll end up signing somebody. Yeah, I think they'll end up signing. I was looking at Darren Collison and Jamal Crawford. Sign those guys, make you an elite team. That's what I would say. But the Clippers did make a gutsy move going after Marcus Morris. Keeping on the topic of the NBA in a roundabout way, I'm going to go something with the Lakers for my blazing. It's a little bit more of a somber note. It's not something exciting that happened, but it's something that I think is appropriately done by the Lakers, a class organization. Of course, Kobe Bryant, a few weeks ago, he and his daughter, along with seven other passengers, passed away in a helicopter crash. The Lakers have announced that the memorial service will be held at Staples Center, honoring Gigi and Kobe Bryant on February 24th, 2024, 2020. Befitting, because Gigi's number was number 2 when she played. Kobe Bryant, of course, number 24. So just kind of a classy thing to do for the Lakers organization on February 24th. A not classy thing, kind of a spinoff to that, something that I wanted to talk about. Gail King her interview with Lisa Leslie. Did you guys listen or watch that interview? Because there's been some hot takes about it. Snoop Dogg responded to Gayle King, who kind of crossed the line, in my opinion, in her interview with Lisa Leslie.
Did she, though?
This is my take on it. Gayle King was doing her job journalistically, I guess, and that's what she's been saying. That's what everybody's been saying, defending her. That come, and she did, with her first question being, does his sexual assault charge, the case that was dismissed in 2003, 2004, of course, the sexual assault in Colorado, does that case make his legacy complicated for you? Talking to Lisa Leslie.
Yes.
That's a question. That's a fair game question there, in my opinion. And I'll defend that as a reporter, somebody in the media. That's a fair game question. Lisa's response, it's not at all to me. It's not complicated. That's not the person I knew, such and such. This is
I think that's a fair response as well.
That's a very fair response. That's not the person I knew. I knew Kobe as a friendly person, not, to be a womanizer or anything like that.
And Gayle King made the to you.
And that's the point where I will stop defending Gayle, because she at this point doubles down now and makes it about attacking Kobe Bryant as a person. Not only attacking Kobe Bryant and his character and his decision making 15, 17 years ago, but then also questioning Lisa Leslie's judge of character as if somehow she was oblivious. I mean, when she doubles down and says, but you wouldn't, though. It's your friend. You wouldn't recognize it. You wouldn't see it. You wouldn't see this monster in laying in wait. And then, Lisa Leslie graciously, it's possible that that's the case. But again, you ask me a question. You're talking to me. You've been walking around my house all day. You're talking to me, and I give you my opinion. Then Gayle goes on to double down on it and kind of put her foot in her own mouth in a way. And this is the weirdest question to me, and I'm going to try to read it. I wrote it down. Is it even fair, Gayle says, is it even a fair question to talk about it, considering that he's no longer here with us and that it was resolved? Or it really is it a part of his history? So in that question, she answers the question. Like, it's not appropriate to talk about it at this point because he's not here anymore. He were mourning his death. His life was more than just this incident. I get it. It's an important part of his history. But in that question, she says it was resolved.
Yeah.
The victim of the crime resolved it by saying she does not want to testify. There was a civil suit in which Kobe Bryant was forced to give an apology and pay an undisclosed amount to this victim. It was resolved 17 years ago. So at this point, for you to be asking questions, yes, it's not appropriate to be talking about it.
The thing is, it's not unfair to bring it up, right? Because it did happen. He did face this trial. He did issue an apology. So it's not unfair to bring it up when discussing him. However, as you said, it's a bit unfair to question Lisa Leslie's judgment.
Yes.
Because you asked Lisa Leslie a question. And you know what? And I think I speak for a lot of people when I say we all have that friend that we know
made a mistake.
Has at one point or another done something really stupid. None of us were there with Kobe. Lisa Leslie wasn't there with Kobe. The only people who truly know what happened were Kobe and the girl who filed the charges.
Exactly. Right?
And there were some real questions about her story. Her character, right? And it's not unfair to bring that up either.
Right. And she's at least living.
Yes.
That's the point. When you question anything about it, she's here still. She's alive. You know what?
She has gone on with her life.
Right.
And
so has Kobe.
And Kobe, I think, did as well.
That's the takeaway.
Kobe's family did. And you know what? It was a very complicated situation. Clearly, there were more complications to that matter than any of us will ever know.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And no, it's not unfair to bring it up, but it's unfair to question the character of his friends.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're interviewing his friend about his life and his legacy. So interview the friend on what he meant to her.
And
you know what?
And he's not here to... But the thing is, had Kobe Bryant 2 weeks ago not passed away in that helicopter crash...
You don't ask that question.
Nobody's even talking about the sexual assault case.
No, absolutely not.
Because... It's been a moot point for 17 years. You know, that's how long it's been a moot point for a really, really long time.
And Kobe's story, yes, this incident in 2003 is a part of his legacy. And I think as a fan of him and as a fan of, what Kobe did, I think it's more a part of his redemption side of his legacy. It's been 15 years. If and Lisa Leslie even said it. I think the media should be more respectful. It's been 17 years. This has been over. If you had questions about it, you should have asked it then. And Kobe has actually done interviews and specials and one-on-one talks with people about the incident and how it changed him and how he's trying to move past it and be a better person because of it. But Gayle King, and again, stepping more out of line here, when Lisa Leslie says that case is resolved, it's over. And she said, yeah, but the case was dismissed. This is a quote from her. Yeah, but the case was dismissed because the victim in the case refused to testify. So it was dismissed. And insinuating in that moment that you can say that it was dismissed, that it was resolved, but we know he was guilty. We know he did this.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, is where she crossed the line. So she's getting backlash. She's panicking. Oprah says she's crying. She's not handling it well. So there's people coming to defend her, but Snoop Dogg did not show mercy. He came after her with everything he had. So I'll put a bow on that. I think Gayle started off doing the right thing, bringing it up, but crossed several lines along the way during that interview. We got to take a break. We kind of got off track with that, but we'll take a break on the other side. We have some Fact This, UNLV football. We'll talk some Raiders as well on the other side. We'll be right back.
Fact This. Fact This. If you don't like the facts, take your ass back to bed. Fact This.
It's a fact that UNLV football welcomed its first recruiting class of the Marcus Arroyo era last Wednesday. During the school's first live-streamed National Signing Day broadcast, they had it streaming on their Twitter page and on the UNLV Athletics website as well. The class includes 28 players, 23 high school, 3 junior college transfers, and 2 4-year college transfers, and is ranked by rivals as the number one recruiting class in the Mountain West Conference and by 24/7 Sports, which is the majority-used website, as the number 2 class, just behind Boise State. This is the best recruiting class UNLV has had in its history as a football program, based on the 22 three-star recruits that are included in the class. The previous record for three-star recruits for UNLV recruiting class was 12. That record was back in 2010. The conference ranking highest prior to this season was 2016's third ranked in the Mountain Quest. Has Coach Arroyo, this to me is a no-brainer, has he proved himself as an elite recruiter as he was advertised before taking this job?
If you want to look at the facts, I'll say this. The year before he came to Oregon, just as an offensive coordinator, they were 27th ranked recruiting class. Then they went to 19th, and then the next year they went to 13th. So, and they have said in multiple interviews that he has been a huge part of that, and, I mean, this is just more proof.
It's evidence, and I think this is – it was key to UNLV to make up some ground in the conference, especially. Not just, you know, we're not talking Power 5 because we're not competing with Power 5 schools here necessarily. We're competing with Group of 5 schools and specifically Mountain West Conference schools. And we saw a lot throughout this recruiting process. There were some steals that he stole from Boise State, from Utah State. He even stole some recruits from Power 5 schools as well. Like, there was up until the last week of recruiting, Brendan Scott was taking trips to Pac-10 schools. He was taking trips there. Pac-12. I said Pac-10, didn't I?
Yeah.
Corrected myself and then made it wrong again.
Right.
Wow, bonehead. But Brendan Scott took trips to USC, ASU, Arizona. LaShawn Bell, these are their prized recruits of this class, was taking trips to Washington State. He was in Washington State the week before signing day. So those are the kind of recruits that usually end up going. But these recruits kept their commitment to UNLV. They signed on Wednesday and made this the best recruiting class in history. It's hard for me to say that because I was once a UNLV recruit.
Should,
so I'm just like
admitting.
You alone
should be the best recruiting class. Anybody who gets you is the best recruiting class. I was number one.
Hey, like, get off my back about it. No, but a great recruiting class. Also includes a couple of transfers from TCU, which is a great program as far as football goes. They have been a solid program for maybe the last decade and a half, TCU has been. But Justin Rogers, the quarterback who transferred from TCU, and Adam Plant, who is a Bishop Gorman graduate, who was also at TCU, a defensive end, a huge mammoth of a man. I actually got a chance to meet him. He's giant. It's ridiculous. He's a pass rusher. Justin Rogers had some injuries the past couple years. He got injured his senior year in high school, fell off the radar. But he was coming out of high school. He was, I believe, the 28th ranked recruit in the nation. So that's a huge get for UNLV.
And I think that was always going to be the key. I never believed that Oblad was going to be the starting quarterback next year. I just don't think he has the skill set, especially that Marcus Arroyo is looking for. So I thought this recruiting class was the most important for him to get the guy who he believes can play quarterback for his system.
And I think he got two because he also got Doug Broomfield, the quarterback from Sarah High School in California, who's a three-star recruit himself, 6'5". 215, I think, just around there that he weighs. He's going to be the quarterback of the future. I think if all things go according to plan, while Armani Rogers and Kenyon Oblad are on the roster still as of the spring, there'll be a crowded quarterback room, to say the least. I think the plan would be ideally for Coach Arroyo and his staff to have Justin Rogers come in immediately and make an impact, with Broomfield developing behind the scenes, redshirting, and then, you know, having time to develop and become a collegiate athlete before taking his first snaps. But that all, of course, is depending on Justin Rogers clearing waivers, because he still has to do that. The transfer waivers, he has to clear that before he can play, but there shouldn't be a problem. We haven't seen a problem nationally for guys clearing waivers and being able to play that next fall. So Justin Rogers, along with the rest of those recruits, looking to make an immediate impact for UNLV. The Fertitta Complex obviously playing a part in how many of these recruits stayed faithful to their commitments. Allegiant Stadium also, of course, playing a huge part. So UNLV did a great job. Coach Arroyo off to a great start. And they did this with 30 days, essentially. A lot of people criticized Arroyo early because he didn't sign any of the commits in that early signing period in December. And that was criticized. People were like, hey, we need to get on this. There was a big deal about it. So in 30 days to pull off this haul of 28 players, quality players, you got to tip your hat to the guy and his staff. They did a great job. And the number's 28. Usually the annual cap for scholarship players to be added to the roster is 25. UNLV got three extras because they didn't use three last year. They had three scholarships basically to spare, so they got an extra three, which helps. You got some more quality, some more depth for this season. But I think UNLV can expect some good things for Arroyo in the future. I don't know if instant wins.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask you. What are the? So we have the number one recruiting class in Mountain West. What are your expectations for year one?
You know what? The thing is, it's not even about the recruiting class. It's about the people that are returning. I think if everybody that was on the roster that, you know, is here now that didn't transfer in the fall, because they all had an opportunity to transfer when Coach Sanchez got fired, none of them entered the portal. I think there's one offensive lineman who wasn't a starter on the depth chart, but that was it. Like, everybody else is returning, essentially, if they didn't get lost to graduation. But I think the roster that was returning should have been able to compete in the Mountain West last year. And I think we all can say that maybe with better coaching, with better game planning, with a better offensive scheme with more consistency on defense, I think this team could have been mid-level in the conference and could have competed. If you look at last season, I know things are different this season, but if you look at last season, the teams that finished in the Mountain West Championship, San Diego State and Hawaii, both of those teams, we played well. UNLV played well. And didn't find a way to pull it out. San Diego State was kind of a gut punch because they had that game. It was a missed field goal away from going to overtime. Hawaii was a back-and-forth game where we forced them to throw the most interceptions they'd thrown all season at that point. I think we ended up with five turnovers that we forced, but weren't able to come up with a win. And then you look at what's happened this offseason. San Diego State, for the first time, is not going to have Rocky Long as a head coach going into a season. This is the first time since forever. Yeah. I mean, he's been there, you know, since they painted the walls at Qualcomm. Like, he's been there forever. So, you know, Hawaii losing their coach, which was, I mean, he went to Washington State, obviously, for the money. I mean, Hawaii couldn't compete with the paycheck. And then, of course, going to a Power 5 school, Washington State. The movement in the conference in that way, I think, opens the door in a lot of ways for UNLV. So this is a year they can capitalize, and I think UNLV's made improvements everywhere. The quarterback position will be improved. One way or another, they'll be better at quarterback
this
year.
It'll be better.
The wide receiver room didn't lose anybody. The best receivers are back.
And our receivers actually were quite impressive.
Randall Grimes is one of the best receivers in the conference. He was a sophomore last year. He's going to be back. You got Tylee Collins, who was a sophomore last year. Underused, I think, in the last system. So I think Charles Williams, who's the number one running back in the conference, number three in the nation, I believe, up until he got injured during that Wyoming game. But that, like, they have pieces on that side of the ball to compete. Now with Arroyo's offensive scheme, we'll see. I mean, I think they should be able to compete in the conference.
Would you say that if Marcus Arroyo was the coach last year for UNLV, they would have went to a bowl game?
Oh, that's I don't know if he would have had to be the head coach last year. And that's the thing about it. I think if he was the offensive coordinator last year, that would have been, because people forget Barney Cotton was the offensive coordinator. He had a heart surgery last offseason in July, which was kind of blindside to everybody. He's been the offensive coordinator for the past 4 years, and their offense under him has averaged 28 points, been one of the top offenses in the conference with Barney Cotton. Offense was never the issue for UNLV. With him leaving and Coach Justice taking over, that was a big hit, I think, to the scheming of the offense. I don't think anybody had as much of an imprint on that offense as Coach Cotton did. So losing him, I think, was an underrated disadvantage that UNLV had going into the season. Of course, health reasons are our number one priority. Hopefully, he had a successful surgery during the season last year. The updates on him will continue to come out. But losing him, I think, losing that offensive coordinator presence on the offense is probably the reason why you saw such an inconsistent UNLV offense last year. So I think Coach Arroyo is an offensive coach, and he hasn't officially named himself the offensive coordinator. But
he will be. Even if he hires an offensive coordinator, we know who will be calling the plays.
Absolutely. He's going to be making decisions there. And I wouldn't be surprised if there is no – at this point, they're getting ready for spring ball now. This is a big-time install period where you're getting your system in. If you don't have an offensive coordinator hired at this point, if you don't have somebody in a roster that's designated as offensive coordinator, essentially – you're doing it as a head coach. And I don't – that's not, you know, a far-fetched thing. There's been plenty of head coach slash offensive coordinators throughout football history. And I think this is probably one of those gigs where he does that job. So we'll see. I think they should have a pretty good – I say 6 wins isn't even far-fetched. I know it's year one for a coach. But with everything that's lined up the way it is, I think year one can be a very successful
Marcus
year.
Marcus Arroyo is an NFL-caliber coach. And that's actually going to transition what I was going to say. Let's say he brings UNLV to a bowl game year two. He's looking to go back to the NFL. He stated that after he got fired from the Buccaneers. Would you be upset if he takes us to a bowl game year two and then just leaves to go to the NFL?
I don't think it would happen that fast, number one. I think year two, this is something that Tony spoke to when he left. I think UNLV needs consistency, and this from top, bottom, president, AD, all that. I think it's not a secret necessarily, that, like you said, that he said that. Those statements have been made. Maybe he becoming a head coach for the first time changes that, and he –
why he took the job ultimately.
Right.
Because this is his best chance. He's not going to get back to the NFL as an offensive coordinator.
And I agree with that. But I think you get a taste of this kind of control and this power of an organization, of a team, and you make all these decisions from recruiting to signing to the offense to whatever other decisions the head coach gets to make. And he has a beautiful office, not to mention, in lovely Las Vegas, a fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. Maybe that coaxes him into staying. Hopefully, for the program's sake, I think that would be great if he stays around for 6, 7, 10 years. That would be awesome. And then, of course, Desiree, who hired him, Marie Francois, if she stays and keeps that consistency with the AD and the coaching relationship, they have a great relationship because of their past together and the way their paths have crossed in the past. They stay together, for instance, and then the president stays the same. So there's a consistent theme of football being a priority. Can the Rebel program tone into what San Diego State was under Rocky Long? Because he was a good coach since the beginning of his time at San Diego State. They've just been a consistent kind of presence in the Mountain West. That's the hope for me. I would hope that that's the thing. But you can't make that personal decision for somebody. If that's his goal, then you can't blame him for going after that. But hopefully, at least he gives us some winning seasons. If they get to a bowl game year two, I wouldn't be surprised year one. And that's my way too early thing. But I think
you're putting it in stone. I'm writing it down right now.
Write it down. Just write it down in
pen. Sticky notes on the walls. Of all these outrageous things that we say. Guys,
yeah, all the outrageous things. UNLV in a bowl game in 2020. Yeah, book it. But no, I don't think it'll be that far fetched. And if he does that, and UNLV has a few winning seasons, I think the program's in a better place. Even if he does decide to leave, but that's way down the line. And I think we're putting the cart before the horse a little bit.
But I just know it's on the back of his mind always.
Hey, we'll see.
And if you want consistency and he leaves year two or year three, I mean, I don't know. If I see him in a bowl game, I guess I can go to sleep happy.
Yeah. You can live with that. But I think there's some more interesting things to talk about as far as what we can see from the future for UNLV. Some of it's some turmoil already. The Allegiant Stadium issue. We'll talk about that on the other side of this break, though, because we got to take this break. I like to take the breaks early, get them out of the way so we can keep talking on the other side. But we'll talk about the Raiders and what their conflict with UNLV is going on right now. We're back for the last portion of the show. And as promised, we're talking some Raiders, S&B with C. We mentioned before the break the UNLV and the Raiders conflict going on right now. But before that, we got some more interesting news. Me and the Wiz have been talking about this in weeks leading up.
I'm excited. I've been waiting for this moment all week.
I just can't wait to argue this with me. But with free agency pending in March, of course, the draft and the combine, things like that going on, of course, there's been speculation, and it's just speculation.
I'm not going to come on here and tell you Tom Brady's going to sign with the Raiders tomorrow. I was hoping during the Super Bowl commercial, actually, I was sitting there just waiting for him to say that, like, John Gruden's going to come out of nowhere and hug him or something like that.
You ready, men? Yeah. You ready? Knock if you're with me. Like,
that would be the greatest Super Bowl commercial of all time.
If Gruden's just in the audience while
I would have cried.
And he's like, knock if you're with me. And then Brady, like, knocks on the wall. Oh, my God, that'd be great. No, but there's speculation that Tom Brady in his free agency has chosen or is looking at the Las Vegas Raiders as one of his primary landing spots. And there, he's bought a house in Vegas and all that kind of thing that people read into as that means he's coming. People are saying that it's the best fit for him as far as winning another Super Bowl. They have good pieces in place. Darren Waller. He loves his tight ends. Darren Waller is the best, obviously.
He's got a slot receiver. They just re-signed Jalen Richard. He's got a receiving back.
And if you look at it, there's pieces in place. Josh Jacobs, of course, the 1,000-yard running back, who offensive rookie of the year, had a strong case for it. But with all that being said, I'm not sure this is the way to go. And it's a possible solution. And you have to do some more team building before Tom Brady comes to make them
him,
a Super Bowl
him
contender.
Plus Tom, like the Raiders plus Tom Brady is not ready.
It's
for the
not
Super
ready.
Bowl.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But you get rid of Derek Carr. You free up $18 million in cap space.
And you free up $18 million, I think. But you take a $5 million hit because of that. I think.
Or you trade him.
Cap
I don't think he's untradeable as a quarterback.
Oh, he's definitely tradable. There's plenty of teams
so you
out
can
there
save
that would
you don't have
Derek
to take
Carr.
The cap hit.
But that's a lot of complicated things that would have to fall into place before you sign Tom Brady. And unfortunately, some of the things that I think would need to happen would be what the Raiders would do in the draft. And that you won't know. I don't think Tom Brady's going to last on the free agent market that long.
The longer Tom Brady's on the free agent market, the better it is for the Raiders.
Absolutely. I think if he lasts on the free agent market to close to the draft time, I think it's good because the Raiders have two first-round picks. Because
then they can ask him what he wants, who they want him to draft, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's what it comes down to. And I think that to me, if you're Tom Brady and looking at it, there's a no-brainer. And to the Raiders organization, if you're looking at what the roster needs, there's a no-brainer. If you get this player at the number 12 spot, I think it's a no-brainer. You take him. And that's Jerry Jeudy. The best receiver in this draft, Mel Kiper, who has been terribly wrong on all of his draft boards throughout the years, and he has credibility for some reason. I don't understand it, but he said Jerry Jeudy would go 13th. If Jerry Jeudy falls that far in this draft, I will be shocked. But if he does, that means that the Raiders, with their 12th pick in the first round, have a chance. If he's there and available, you take Jerry Jeudy. The offense has added a dynamic weapon. I think the best receiver in the draft. Some people have CeeDee Lamb as that, but I don't see it. I think CeeDee Lamb is a system receiver.
I'm okay
receiver.
With either CeeDee Lamb or Jerry Jeudy. The only player who I don't want is Ruggs. He's the raw. He's fast. He's the next Jacoby Ford. If any Raiders fans out there remember Jacoby Ford, he was like literally just the fastest player in the draft. As long as it's either CeeDee Lamb or Jerry Jeudy, that's the guy who I want in the first round.
Yeah, and I think that's if you can get one of those guys, it's a very good addition. I think, like we said earlier, Darren Waller at tight end with Hunter Renfrow at the slot receiver, essentially, and then you add a Jerry Jeudy outside. You have a three-headed monster in the receiving core that I think honestly would help Derek Carr, even if Derek Carr ended up being the quarterback, and it would help that offense produce more, even though they produce well offensively. So then the next problem that the Raiders have is the defensive side of the ball. A linebacking core that is obsolete. I think that's
there's
the primary
There's not one starter
focus.
At
There's
linebacker.
Absolutely not.
Now, you hear Whitehead used to complain in the beginning of the season about the linebacking core. It's like, you're a part of it, brother.
Yeah,
like
you're
the big problem.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
are the problem.
So that's going to be addressed, obviously, in the offseason, either through free agency or through the draft or possibly through trades. I don't know. But these are some issues that I think would have to happen to make the team a good fit for Tom Brady to come. That's what kind of the topic is right now. How do you make it a good fit for Tom Brady? Because I think there's better fits out there. But the linebacker core needs to be addressed, and you need some help in the secondary. I know you're getting Jonathan Abrams back from injury, who was expected to make a big impact last year. We saw some flashes as a rookie, but he was hurt all season. So we don't know necessarily, but he should be a good piece in the secondary. But you need more pieces on that side before you can say, okay, we got a contender. Then not to mention, with all of that going on, there's still some juggernauts in the AFC. I know in your division, you might say you're getting to the playoffs, but in the AFC now, in the division, there's some juggernauts that you're going to have to go. The gauntlet of the AFC
well, the real
is
gauntlet
tough.
Is the Chiefs because Phillip Rivers isn't going to be a Charger next year.
And that's, but,
least,
that, but you got the Baltimore Ravens.
I'm not too afraid.
The Baltimore Ravens who are still
well, taking
dealing
a trip
with,
to the Super Bowl. Yeah, of course. Well,
dealing
are
with
you
Lamar
really scared
Jackson.
Of the Baltimore Ravens
yes,
at this point?
Absolutely.
They've choked twice in a row.
That's fine. But
their
they
offense
still,
looks not good
what
in,
they
in the
have,
playoffs.
What they have is a rookie quarterback on a rookie contract and a lot of cap space to make some improvements because Joe Flacco's contract is no longer
what
a burden to
them
after
being
this
a Super
year.
Bowl? What stopped the Ravens from going to the Super Bowl last year?
They had a bad game. That's all. I honestly think that's why the NFL is so
Lamar
exciting.
Lamar Jackson isn't
because you
good
can do
enough
everything
as a passer to take a team to the Super Bowl.
He passed for 350 yards in that playoff
loss.
He
had two interceptions.
That's fine. I, so
and
did,
a fumble.
Patrick Mahomes had two interceptions in the Super Bowl. He was the MVP of that game.
Would you not say that?
I mean, he shouldn't have been the MVP.
He shouldn't have
game.
Been? We'll talk about it in a minute. But you,
well, you better hurry. You only have a few minutes left.
Yeah. So we'll skip over that. But,
he's
but again,
his
we talked about
Mag.
I was pointing
very,
my finger at Mag.
Very adamant.
But the big deal with the Raiders that we're concerned with right now in the immediate future is UNLV in this dispute with the games at Allegiant Stadiums. They're trying to force UNLV to give up some of their non-conference games. They were promising a contract to have available was it three? I think it was three non-conference games at Allegiant Stadium. They have the home opener against Cal August 29th. That's not in question. But ASU and Louisiana Tech, September 12th and September 5th, those games that are scheduled to be at Allegiant Stadium, home games for UNLV, are now in question because of concerts that should be slated for those games in the fall on Saturday when college football is king, and everybody knows that. So there's a dispute right now trying to figure out when they're going to be able to play, what's going to happen. If they're not able to play at the Allegiant Stadium, then they'll have to go to Sam Boyd, which nobody wants to do, but we'll see how that shakes out. That leads, I'm going to do this now because I want to get into what you just said, into the Super Bowl recap. Because the Super Bowl was last week.
This is proof that Derek Carr can't be the quarterback of the Raiders.
That is not – how did that – what? How did that become the topic?
You have an average quarterback, and look what he did. You said that Jimmy Garoppolo could lead a team to the Super Bowl. That is proof that he could never do that.
I said
yes, we talked about that.
Wait a minute. Listen, hold on.
First of all, Jimmy Garoppolo was a 3rd-and-15 fail by the 49ers defense away from winning a Super Bowl.
He had two chances to win them the Super Bowl with the ball in his hands. Are we really going to argue this right now?
Defense let them down?
Are we going to forget it? First of all, the 3rd and 15.
I'm not talking about
the 3rd and 15, you give up a 40-yard bomb.
That is the biggest play of the game.
That's one.
Yep.
Then Richard Sherman gets the best defender, gets cooked on the game winning
drive. By Sammy Watkins, who's at the end of the line.
Ignoring the fact that he had a chance to, first of all, end the game, and he couldn't get a first down.
And I'm going to get to that, because I said, if there's a situation, this is where you need a great quarterback, where greatness as a quarterback shines. Yeah. When your defense doesn't get you the win, when the team doesn't get you the win, you do need
Jimmy
a quarterback.
Garoppolo cannot get you
and
a win.
You didn't even have to be great. You just had to hit a wide open guy for a game winning touchdown. The play was dialed up perfectly. The guy ran a perfect route, toasted two defenders, and you overthrew him by 8 yards.
That's what a Derek Carr would do for your
this.
Team.
I said this before. I said Jimmy G. I do not trust Jimmy G. I said I trust Derek Carr more than Jimmy G, honestly. But I did not trust Jimmy G, and that's where the game came down to. It was a great game.
It was amazing.
It was a great game. Well worth the watch. I watched it from start to finish. A great game. But to what Mag said earlier that I got to get on him about, if Patrick Mahomes doesn't deserve the MVP of that game,
should have been Damian Williams.
Why? Tell me why.
Over 100 yards rushing, two touchdowns.
Okay.
Sealed the game with that.
I'm gonna blow this one up because I've been waiting for somebody to say that. Damian Williams had 66 yards rushing, zero rushing touchdowns before that last drive of the game. In cleanup mode, they needed a first down to just trying to run the clock out. 38 yards on that put him over 100. That's number one. And then that touchdown gave him his only rushing touchdown. So
quarterback always going to stick up for the quarterback.
In one play after the comeback that actually won the game, after the comeback, this guy got some stats.
It's got to be the lowest QBR for any Super Bowl MVP.
Hey, I'm fine with that.
All time.
But there's no doubt in my mind that the most valuable person in that game was Patrick Mahomes. Without that, Damian Williams doesn't make
that
comeback.
If you don't give up that third down,
get out of here.
He has like one of the worst performances in a Super Bowl.
Who threw that third down?
Yeah.
Patrick Mahomes still threw it. Let's take away his best play of the game and then say he's not the MVP.
Tyreek Hill had
Patrick
to run the
Mahomes,
route, get
youngest,
behind the defenders.
Youngest Super Bowl MVP and league MVP of all time. He's the GOAT. Patrick Mahomes, bright future ahead in Kansas City.
Of course.
We are just about out of time, but I had to end it with that. We didn't get to our Oscar picks. You can watch the Oscars tonight and figure it out for yourself. Thank you for everybody that joined in, which is just me, Chris Maggs, and the Wiz! Brian Feldman, enjoy your vacation. We'll be back next week, same time, same place.